Good morning and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today is owls in Alaska. Why? Because owls are coming into an active time now and through the next several months with mating calls, nesting, egg laying, and fledgling young. Alaska is a great place to learn about owls. In fact, we have an owl on the show today, and you'll probably hear him hooting from time to time. He's a great horned owl named Archimedes, cared for by another guest today, biologist Gina Maria Smith. We also have other humans on our show, all owl enthusiasts with us today, including wildlife photographer Colin Tyler, a volunteer research biologist Andrew Fisher, and finally Denver Holt of the Owl Research Institute in Missoula, Montana. He's been coming to Alaska for 30 years studying the snowy owls outside Ukiavik. All of our guests are passionate about owls, and they'll share their experiences caring for, observing, and photographing Alaska's owls. We hope you have owl experiences you want to share and questions you'd like to ask. So we welcome your questions anytime during the show. I'll give out the numbers a couple times, but in Anchorage, the number is 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752. And of course, we'll check our email at hometown@alaskapublic.org throughout the show. We've got a lot on our agenda. The first part of our show, we're really going to be talking to two owl enthusiasts and experts who photograph owls, caretake, I guess you could say, owls. So let me bring our guests on and we'll get started right away. I'd like to welcome Gina Maria Smith. Welcome.
Thank you for having Archimedes, the Great Horned Owl, and I on this morning.
And we can probably hear Archimedes hooting just a little bit in the background. He's a great horned owl, and he's probably sitting on Gina Maria's arm. By the way, to our listeners, if you want to see what Archimedes looks like, I took a screenshot. Gina Maria was giving a talk at the Eagle River Nature Center by Zoom yesterday, and I did grab a screenshot of her and Archimedes, who were providing lots of information about owls in Alaska, just because this is an owl time. And I'd also like to welcome Colin Tyler. Welcome, Colin.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And I'd also like to tell our listeners that your photography is anchoring our alaskapublic.org/hometown page today. And they're just really, you allowed us to use three of your images, and they're quite beautiful. Probably taken at the Eagle River Nature Center. Is that right, Colin?
That is correct. Yes, they're all from within this vicinity.
Yeah. So what I wanted to do this first section of our show is just talk about the amazing features of owls, because I think that's probably one of the reasons we're attracted to them. And Gina Maria, I'm going to turn to you a little bit. One of the first things that we notice about owls, and one of the things that probably attracts us to them, is the fact that their necks can turn, 180 degrees. Tell us a little bit about what's so special about their necks.
So owls aren't able to move their eyes. Their eyes are so large and take up so much space in their skulls because they're more tubular shaped than ours that they don't have the muscles to move them like what we can do with our eyes. And instead, they have extra bones in their neck. So they have 14 mm-hmm. cervical vertebrae compared to our 7, and that allows them to pivot and see what's going on around them instead of moving their eyes up and down or sideways the way that we do. And then when they're turning their heads, a lot of people think that they can turn their heads all the way around or that they get spun up and dizzy like you see in cartoons, but that's not true. They can turn their heads about 270 degrees or 3/4 of the way around.
Right, right. And I heard yesterday you talking about that their eyes are so large in comparison to their body that if it were a human eye, it would be like the size of a grapefruit or something like that in our eye, in our skull.
Yes, just an easy comparison for our listeners is if you think about holding up softballs or grapefruit in front of your eyes, that's a good comparison for what our eyes would be if they were built the same size as an owl's.
Colin and Gina Maria, we welcome callers, and we do have one. I'd like to welcome Stu, who's calling from Muldoon, with a question about owl boxes. Hi, Stu.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've been thinking about putting an owl box up, but we also like to hunt grouse. Which species, if I put an owl box up for a horned owl, I imagine we're going to have grouse depletion, and if I have a northern saw wheat, I don't know. Could you just explain what the effects of owl boxes might be on grouse?
Okay. Stu, I want to say to you that Andrew Fisher, who's a biologist and who's doing a volunteer research project on owl boxes out at the Eagle River Nature Center, we have a link to his talk that he gave, and he does discuss a little bit about placement of owl boxes, and mostly he was talking about, and I'm going to go to our guests and let you answer this too, but was saying, you know, you wouldn't want a great horned owl near a saw-whet owl box, you know, a large owl is going to be a predator on a small owl. But let's see, let's go to Colin. How about you? Have you, in your, experience with working with owl boxes, do you have anything to say about that versus, you know, with the idea of a box for a great horned owl versus a saw-whet owl and the impact on grouse?
That's something I haven't encountered. The boxes that I've seen that I've gone out and checked with Andrew, they're built for the smaller owls. So a grouse or a great horn couldn't fit into the box.
Okay.
So that wouldn't be an issue there. So I haven't seen him put out any boxes for great horned owls. Don't know that he does.
Right. I think if I recall during his talk, and again, I've got that link up on alaskapublic.org/hometown, he did talk about, the fact that a large owl would be a predator on a small owl. But I think that to me, that means that if you put up saw-whet owl boxes, I don't know that saw-whet prey on grouse. Do you know, Colin?
Not that I'm aware of. I think they mostly prey on smaller, voles, mice, maybe smaller birds, things like that. Because they're smaller than an adult grouse.
Yeah, they're like, I think that the size I heard was 100 grams. I mean, really, just a little puffball in your hand.
Yeah, maybe 6 to 8 inches tall.
Yeah.
An adult. So they're smaller than a full-grown grouse.
So they probably would not take on a grouse. I don't know, Stu, does that help a little bit?
Yeah, well, I can hear the northern saw wheat. They're very distinctive birds. So I know they're in my area up in Willow. Another question I had, if I may.
Sure.
We have Beryl's Goldeneye up in Willow around the lakes, and they are tree nesting ducks. Is it possible to do a owl box that can be doubled as a Goldeneye box in season? I don't know what owl, maybe if anybody knows, but I know they nest in trees because I find their eggs up there, their eggshells and stuff. So. But anyhow, they both could use a box, I understand. I'm just wondering if it could be doubled.
Yeah. Oh, let me go to you, Colin, if you have anything to suggest there. And I would say that later we have enthusiasts and biologists with us today, but not necessarily experts in owls, but more passionate about owls. Later in the program, we will have Denver Holt on, who has spent his entire life studying owls with the Owl Research Institute. And he may be able to answer that more specifically for you, Stu. And that's going to be later in the program, probably about 10:40 or so. But anyway, let me go to you, Gina Maria. Anything to add to his question? I don't know that you've dealt with, tree nesting ducks or anything like that.
So Beryl's Goldeneye, like you said, are cavity nesters, and other ducks that are cavity nesters would be wood ducks, mergansers, and if you search online, you can find some great boxes and designs for bringing those birds in. Typically, you're not going to have kind of a shared nest or a double nest, although many times growing up in Wisconsin, we had wood duck boxes out, and they got used by American kestrels, which are small falcons. They got used by other songbirds, at least for that year, and then the next year, they might have been used by wood ducks, And so if you search online and look for a wood duck box, that hole is going to be a lot bigger because obviously a Barrow's goldeneye is going to be larger than what a sawwood owl would be. But if they find cavities and they're somewhere that's in a good location, then they can be used by a variety of smaller birds. And with your first question about the sawwets and problems with grouse, sawwets and boreal owls, which are what the smaller nesting boxes are put up to attract, you don't have to worry about them interacting with grouse in any negative manner since they're so small.
Well, I have to say hats off to you, Gina Maria. I didn't know that you would be ready to jump in and answer almost any owl question. So thank you so much. That's great. Stu, I do have a link to the ornithology lab, Cornell Ornithology Lab, because they have nest boxes and lots of information. I put a couple of links on our webpage to that. Of course, you can Google it and find it easily. Okay, that's really great. Anything else, Stu?
I love your show.
Great. So glad. I'm so glad that you're able to do it. So, I want to take a moment just because it's so much fun to hear owls that I would like to play a little bit of owl call for you. And, you know, part of the purpose of this show is to let you know what resources are out there. And so there is a program at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that provided owl calls or bird calls, but also owl calls. And we obtained one of those. This is about a minute and 30 seconds, and you're going to hear a couple of different kinds of owl calls described during the recording. So let's just give it a listen just for some fun, and I might come back to you, Gina Maria, and see what Archimedes, how he reacts to hearing these owl calls. So let's give it a listen.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. On a spring night, the call of a northern saw-whet owl echoes through the forest. Saw-whet owls are one of about 10 owl species found in Alaska. While owls may not be readily seen, they can be heard, especially in the spring, and most of Alaska's owls can be identified by their distinct calls. Saw-whet owls are tiny forest owls. They're quiet most of the year, as they're prey for larger owls. But in the spring, they are quite vocal, and males can broadcast this one-note mating call for hours. The western screech owl has a call like a bouncing ball, the hoots speeding up over the course of the call. The owl's name is misleading, as it isn't really known to screech. Like the saw-whet, it's a small forest owl found in southeast and south-central Alaska. Barred owls are newcomers to Alaska. They are close cousins to the spotted owl of the American West and will hybridize with spotted owls. A century ago, barred owls were found primarily in the American South, where they're known as hoot owls. But over the latter half of the 20th century, they extended their range north and west. They were first documented in southeast Alaska in the 1970s, and now they're relatively common. These territorial owls readily respond to hooting and will answer an imitated call. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford. Sounds Wild is brought to you by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Okay, that was really fun to give it a listen to. First, I want to go to Gina Maria. Did you get any reaction from Archimedes listening to other owls?
Was looking around trying to find where the sound was coming from. He definitely is interested in that. The call he just gave is a perfect example of a great horned owl call and what people can typically hear around their houses. I know in Anchorage we've been hearing a lot of wild great horned owls lately. They've started calling to each other and then hearing northern saw-whet owls and boreal owls as well. So all three owls have been active already, and I've been able to hear them around both Eagle River and Anchorage so far.
Pretty interesting. I want to talk a little bit more about the special characteristics of owls, and then I want to save a little bit of time, Colin, before we take a break, to talk a little bit about, there's one image that you've shared on our website with an owl with its wings just spread out. It's a beautiful image, and a little bit about how you got that image. So first, I want to talk about the ears real quick, Gina Maria. They're really interesting because they have different ears than we do, and they're asymmetrical. Can you talk a little bit about why that's significant?
So most owl ears are, they don't have external ear flaps like what we do. They're just holes in the side of their head, and their designs of their facial discs, which are the flat feathers on the front of their face surrounding their eyes, can help to bring sound waves back to those ears, and the asymmetricalness helps them to pick up different sounds. So owls will sit and they'll listen, and when a little mouse runs past underneath the snow, it makes sound waves, and when those sound waves come up, the owl can pick up different sound waves and basically pinpoint where that mouse is so that it can swoop down and grab it for dinner. And it's using triangulation the same way that when we're using a cell phone, we have a cell phone, a cell tower, and a satellite forming the three points of a triangle. And when owls are hunting, their two ears form two points of a triangle, and then the prey item is the third point of a triangle. So it really helps hunters, since they're not relying just on their eyesight when they're hunting.
Okay, and there's other features of owls that we're going to talk about as the program goes on. But Colin, I really want to talk a little bit to you about your photography, and you know, how do you? What tips do you have? First of all, that beautiful image that you loaned to us, and it's on our website. How did you get that? Because I think there's a story behind that about the endeavor you had to put into getting it.
Yeah, that was a couple weeks in the making to capture that image. That was taken in 2015 in August, and there was a pair of great horned owls around the vicinity of the nature center here, and I saw them daily. And every night by sundown, like clockwork, one of them would be in this particular tree every night. So I was going out most nights. And I had an image in mind of an owl taking flight with maybe a sunset sky or something behind it. And I did use a flash, which I researched that prior, to make sure that wouldn't affect their behavior, their eyesight, wouldn't be harmful in any way. And all the research that I found was, no, it does not harm them. And I found a lot of owl images where a flash was used.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I looked into that thoroughly first, and I would go out at night, and, you know, like I said, like clockwork, one of them would be in this particular tree every evening, and the other one would be close by. It turned out it was an adult and a juvenile from that year, although the juvenile was full grown at that point. But I could always also locate them by the feeding call. The juvenile would often, it sounds like a person whistling when it's crying to be fed, and I've located them many times using that tactic. But this one in particular, I was using my largest telephoto lens, a flash with a battery pack attached, and I would stay out as long as until it got too dark for my autofocus to work, basically. So it was around 11 p.m. or so. And after that, I just couldn't use the autofocus feature. And I waited patiently. And you know, when one comes in and lands, it could be there for 30 seconds or 30 minutes. You don't know. You have to be patient. And I literally trained myself to use my eyes separately. My left eye, I would be watching the owl perched. My right eye would be looking through the viewfinder and my finger on the shutter and ready to press the button should it start to take off. Or through my left eye, I could detect movement sooner. Literally, it was a shot in the dark, and I would get really just one chance at it, because by the time the flash power had recycled and it had taken flight, trying to focus on a track of moving bird at night is nearly impossible. So I get one chance as it was taking off, and it took many attempts. And finally this night, you know, I was ready. I was in the right place. It was a nice dark cobalt blue sky behind it, and it took off going toward me. And, you know, everything just lined up, and there's a little bit of movement in the wings, which you can see. I was using, photographers might appreciate my settings here. It was 125th of a second shutter speed. So it's hard to freeze any fast motion at that shutter, but the flash helps to freeze some of the motion. So the face and the body of the owl are nice and sharp, which there's a little bit of movement blur in the wings, which I like. So for photographers listening out there, my settings were 125th of a second at F5 and ISO 3200. And again, using a flash and a tripod.
Well, so I do encourage people to go to alaskapublic.org/hometown. You'll see Colin's photos. They're across the top of the page, and they're tiny. But if you click on them, you'll get a very large image, and you'll be able to see all the detail in there that you want. We are going to take a tiny break right now. You are listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. For more information about this episode, visit us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Just to, if you just joined us, our topic today is owls in Alaska, because right now we're coming into a very active time with lots of the owls that live in Alaska. We have 10 types of owls in Alaska. And our guest today, we have an owl on the show, Archimedes. He is an education animal who is being taken care of by a biologist, Gina Maria Smith, who's also on with us today, and Colin Tyler, who is an assistant manager out at the Eagle River Nature Center and spends a lot of time observing and photographing owls and all wildlife. And he's given us three images to share with our audience there on our website. And I just encourage you to go take a look, open them up big, and just enjoy looking at his photography. I would like to, we've got a number of folks calling in, and I'm going to try to move through those calls. But just to alert you that we have an interview coming up with Andrew Fisher, who is a biologist here in Anchorage, but doing a volunteer research project on owl boxes out at the Eagle River Nature Center. We're going to hear from him. It's a pre-recorded interview because he couldn't join us today. But I will take Mark's call. He's been holding. Go ahead, Mark. Quickly, what is your question?
Hi. Yeah. I was wondering if there's a particular spot in the landscape, if you will, that lends itself to attracting owls more than others. For example, along a clearing or in a dense forest, is there one area or another that is suited better for owls? And I'm particularly talking about boreal or saw-whet owls.
Okay. One thing I want to let you know, Mark, there's just this great talk that Andrew Fisher gave, and we have a link to it on our website. He's talking exactly about his owl boxes in the Eagle River Nature Center area. He was building boxes for saw-whet owls. And he talked a lot about, birch trees versus evergreen trees. But Gina Marie, I might just go to you just with your background. Are there a few points you could make for Mark?
Absolutely. So for boreal and saw-whet owls, they're both forest owls. So there, you're going to be looking for areas that have a lot more trees just because they're smaller owls. They don't like to be out in the open where they can become prey instead of being a predator. And when you're searching, and obviously what we're going to get to hear about shortly with Andrew's work, is he'll be able to give descriptions, or even when you look online, of great placement for where you can put those boxes to attract both a saw-whet owl and a boreal owl. And then with other owls, different owls can be found in different habitat types, and so it's really specific to that type of owl. It's not a broad stroke for everything, but boreal and saw-whet owl, if you've got trees and you've got a more forested area, you've got a better chance to bring them in.
All right. So, Mark, I'm going to go ahead. We're going to move and listen to Andrew Fisher's few minutes with us that we had talking a little bit about his project in Eagle River. So let's go ahead and give a listen to Andrew Fisher. So welcome, Andrew. Welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thanks. I'm really happy to have you because, as I told our listeners, you were the one who led me to owls inadvertently. So I wanted to just get you to tell us why owls kind of ring your bells. Why did owls pull you in?
Well, thanks, Kathleen. I have been fascinated with owls since I was a young child growing up overseas in East Africa. I got a call one day from a friend who had found a bird, and we went over and picked it up and looked at it, and it was unlike anything I'd seen before, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And anyhow, we ended up taking it to the National Museum of Kenya, and the curator there told us that it was a baby barn owl. And, you know, we ended up trying to raise it, and that was just one of those fun experiences where you actually get to, you know, have something in your hands. And then later on, my family and I would go on different safaris. And sometimes when we were, you know, in our little vehicle looking for different leopards or lions or whatnot, we would find ourselves at the base of a tree. And oftentimes you'd look up and there was what's the largest owl in Africa, known as the Verroes eagle owl. And they are these 2 foot tall owls, not too different in size from the great gray owls here in North America, but they have 2 horns like great horned owls, and they have these sort of bright pink eyelids that look down at you. And I think just running across them sort of just, you know, out of the blue got me fascinated with where they live and their habits. And yeah, I got my interest in owls growing up overseas and getting to see them firsthand.
And really, you were just a kid at the time, right?
Yeah, I was probably 4 or 5 when I first started seeing them. And you know, we'd see them on safaris every once in a while, but it was always kind of magical when you'd be off on some distant trail and wind up finding one. Sometimes that was better than finding a leopard or rhino or something.
So they're so unusual. So fast forward now. So that passion was sort of started when you were just a tyke. When I met you here in Anchorage a couple weeks ago, you're heavily involved in a big project out at the Eagle River Nature Center. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I first of all, I want to say thanks to all the folks at the Eagle River Nature Center who have let me kind of take over a small owl project that they have out there that was started by the Boy Scouts in the early 2000s, where they put up 15 or so owl boxes for small screech and not screech, saw-whet and boreal owls. And they kind of just put them up and nobody ever monitored them, and they were just sort of left in disrepair. And one winter, I was bored out of my mind and decided to drive down there. And, you know, I just started talking to folks at the Nature Center and told them I'd be interested in putting up some owl boxes if they would let me. And they told me about the Boy Scout project that had been done. And they gave me a map of the owl box locations. And some friends and my wife, we hiked out there. This was 2 years ago in December, and, you know, found the old boxes, took them down, cleaned them out, and we built some new ones and put them up, and then have started monitoring them every year since.
Wow. And how many are there now? Owl boxes?
Yeah, we have 24 owl boxes out at the Nature Center.
And I actually was able to hear a little public talk that you gave through the Nature Center through a Zoom. And I think you have couple of years of data showing that you've actually had some successful nests. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So the project has only been going on for 2 years. The upcoming breeding season will be our third year. And the first year, we just had one successful nest, which, you know, out of 20 or so boxes back then, that was really exciting to actually have an owl use one of the nest boxes and fledge 3 young back in 2019. And then last year was a much better year. We had 4 of the boxes that were used by saw-whet owls, and they fledged between 2 and 5 young in each box. I think we ended up having about 14 young that were fledged in our boxes. And it was exciting to see that, you know, when you go for a hike, you might not realize how alive the forest is with all kinds of different creatures, both daytime and nighttime. And it was just exciting to see the little owls you know, fledged successfully, and hopefully some of them will come back to nest again this year.
That's great. And, you know, just give me a feel for the activity. For example, when I met you one day, you were refreshing an owl box with, you know, some fresh wood shavings, I think, something like that. What is the season like for a year? I realize you're not out there every weekend or anything like that, but there might be a time when you kind of refresh the boxes, and then maybe there's a mating season and a nesting season. Give us a feel for what the year is like.
Yeah, so typically in December, when there's not much else to do, I go out and I clean out all of the boxes that were used the previous season. They get really, you know, full of old pellets and poop and prey remains. And so I usually have to kind of chisel out the old material, which is basically a mat of wood shavings. I pull that out and then I put in new shavings, usually 2 to 3 inches in the bottom of each box. And then I also clean out any squirrel nests or hornet nests that have been in there from the previous season. And then I typically don't check the boxes until early to mid-May sometime. The owls sort of start a pair bond formation, you know, as early as right now. There's actually quite a few saw-whet and boreal and great horned owls calling right now. And they start, the males start calling, they track the female to the nest box. And then, you know, in April, early May, she'll start laying eggs. And so I don't check any of the boxes during that sensitive time because they are prone to nest abandonment. And so I don't visit any of the boxes usually until mid-May, when I know that if they are going to be used, that there's a female in the box with eggs. And I have a small little endoscope that I use to check the box. It's Wi-Fi to my phone, and I'm able to see what's in the box without disturbing the incubating bird. Sometimes, you know, if the owl hears my footsteps walking up, she'll stick her head out. But the camera is, you know, really small. It can go in, look underneath them, and it takes about a minute, and then I walk away, and there's virtually no disturbance. You wouldn't know that I was there. And then that gives me some time to figure out if they're going to, you know, have eggs. And then I usually come back maybe a month later in early to mid-June to see how many young hatched and what age they are. And then last year is the first year with Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We banded all of the young in the boxes out at the Nature Center. We put a Fish and Wildlife Service band on it, which is a, you know, a band that uniquely identifies that owl in that location. And then after that, I don't do anything really until the following December when I clean out the box again. And so, you know, all in all, I might visit a box 3 to 5 times in a year. But if the owls are using it, I try to really minimize disturbance because, you know, the goal is to have it be successful, and I don't want a bear or anything else to try to follow my scent through the box.
And it must be exciting when you see owls that are young, that are, I guess you could say, fledging, you know, testing out their wings. Do you see that in May or June?
Yeah, usually kind of the second to last week in June, the young will start leaving the nest. And this is dependent where you live in Anchorage. Kind of in South Anchorage, the young will fledge a little bit sooner than the young that fledge in Eagle River. And, you know, there's a little bit of a gap there depending on where you're located in the city and when they fledge. But last year we found that the ones at the Nature Center tended to leave the nest around June 26th based on our camera data. We put some cameras out to see if, you know, if the young would leave and if anything was disturbing it. And that's what we found, is that at nighttime, the young would hop out of the nest and they would be gone once they're out.
Wow.
They'd go back, generally.
Wow. Do you know if they return to the same boxes, or is there any kind of pattern that you've detected or know of yet about coming back and reusing the same box?
That's one of the goals of this study, is to kind of figure out how frequently they do that. I know anecdotally from talking to other people who have owl boxes in their backyard that they are sometimes used year after year. I think a lot depends on the small mammal or the rodent population and the bird population. The small owls here eat both small rodents and birds. And so depending on how well the local, you know, climate is in the region for small mammals and nesting birds, I think will depend on whether or not they can find enough food to feed the young. So far at the Nature Center, we have not had an owl reuse the same box that was used the previous year, but hopefully in the next few years, we'll be able to find out, you know, maybe they use a box every third year or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They do reuse the same box from talking to other people.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, I interrupted you in the middle of your workday, so I'm just going to ask you one more question and express my appreciation for you willing to take a break. We couldn't have you on during the live show, but you agreed to a pre-record, so I really appreciate it. But I'd like part of this show is really just talking about why do people love owls? Why are they attracted to owls? And so I just want to ask you, what was one of your best experiences and why was it so special?
Well, the one I was going to share took place a couple of years ago, actually, along the lower Colorado River Valley. I was doing some bird surveys for a project, and there was a great horned owl, actually, that was nesting in a campground. And one of the young had fallen out of the tree. It's really common for them to hop out of the nest. And if they don't quite make it to a nearby branch, they'll fall on the ground. And this young was on the ground, and we went over to pick it up, and the adult owl flew out of the tree and in a split second used her feet and hit me in the back of the head.
Ooh.
Really hard with her feet, and it completely, you know, it didn't knock me off balance, but it was totally unexpected, and it was her way of saying get away from my baby. And, you know, it's very uncommon for a bird to actually physically engage with a human. And she could have chosen, you know, to open her talons, but she decided to foot me instead. And it was that was probably one of the, you know, most exciting experiences that was sort of accidental. And, you know, we ended up putting the young just right back up in the nest all without getting hit in the head again.
Wow. Wow. That was a mama, right? That is just, I can just picture it, Andrew. That's just kind of scary. And was in the back of your head. So that's what a surprise. Physical contact.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm going to say goodbye and thank you so much. And good luck with the project out at the Eagle River Nature Center. And thanks so much for sharing your stories and your experiences here with us on Hometown Alaska. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Kathleen. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye now.
So, welcome back to the live show. I'm going to welcome Jim onto Hometown Alaska. He's been holding a long time with an owl encounter story. And Jim, we have a couple minutes before we have to take a break. So do tell us what happened.
This is interesting, maybe because I had an encounter and just following what we just heard. In the 70s, early 70s, I was a fire lookout. And the area I overlooked was mostly grassland spotted with live oaks. This was in California. And one day I was taking a hike around the mount, and I came across three or four little birds, and I determined they were owlets. And they were so young, they still had the down on their bodies, and they were underneath a live oak tree. I couldn't figure out how they got there and what they were doing. I couldn't see any nest. So I was just looking at them. I didn't approach them too closely. I got within maybe 3 or 4 feet. And suddenly I saw movement off to the left, about 6 or 7 feet away, was the mama great horned owl. And she was on the ground, lifting up one wing. It looked like she was injured. And I just instinctively took a step toward her, and she hopped 2 or 3 hops away from the chicks. And I took another step toward her, and she hopped another 2 or 3 steps away from me. And So finally, not knowing what to do with them, I left them alone. Later on, I found out that the mama's behavior was maybe not so typical as common, in trying to pretend to be injured and lure some potential harm or predator away from her babies. And that was a unique experience for me.
Sure was. Thanks so much for sharing it with us. And actually, Jim, we have to say goodbye and take a little break right now. And we'll be right back. There's so many things that came up in this second section that I'd love to talk to Gina Maria and Colin about. But I hope we get a chance to come back to them. But right now, we're going to take a little break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. And if you've just joined us, we've been on a while, but we're talking about owls. We have several guests with us today. Archimedes is a great horned owl that's on the show with us today, and you might have heard him hooting. He's an education animal cared for by Gina Maria Smith, who is a biologist. And we've also been joined by Colin Tyler, who is a wildlife photographer. Sorry about my froggy throat. And he shared information about how to capture owls with your camera. And now, gosh, I'm sorry. I'd like to welcome Denver Holt onto Hometown Alaska. Welcome, Denver.
Hi, Kathleen. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. I know you're, I think, in Missoula, Montana. And I don't normally have guests from outside of Alaska, but I learned that you have done so much research. Actually, Travis Booms, one of our Alaska fish and game biologists, sent me to you. He said, you've got to talk to Denver because he's been coming up to the North Slope to study snowy owls for 30 years. And, you know, I just kind of thought, wow, you know, that's a long-term study of snowy owls, and I wonder what Denver has learned. And also, I was curious about the, you know, the Owl Research Institute. And so, first of all, Denver, would you just tell us a little bit about 30 years? You can't tell us all about 30 years, but can you tell us what brought you up to start studying snowy owls up there? And what have you learned? And I know you're not done studying, but when will you be producing your work? So go ahead.
All right. First of all, I got to thank Travis for me. I appreciate it. You know, I've been studying owls probably 40 plus years, and within that, you know, it's a long story. But I was always fascinated just with the snowy owl, and I think it was in the 1990 or so that I contacted a friend of mine here in Montana, actually, Derek Craighead, part of the Craighead family, studied grizzly bears at Yellowstone. But his cousin, Craig George, up at the North Slope Rural Department of Wildlife, who studies whales and fish. And so the connection was made. I contacted Craig and asked about snowy owls. It's just one of those things, you know, the big white owl in the north is so fascinating, and owls in general are so fascinating. So contacted Craig. He said, oh, yeah, they're here all the time. They're here every year. They don't nest every year, but most years they do. So come on up. Not easy. And come on up and give it a try. See what you want to do. And I made all the arrangements, and I finally got there by 1992 and then established a study on snowy owls. And in doing so, you can't study snowy owls without studying lemmings. And so I established the lemming study alongside the snowy owl study. And this year will be my 30th year going up there with a number of people who have helped me over the years.
Mm. I bet you saw the headline in the, I think it was in the New York Times. I saw it on Twitter about the snowy owl that showed up in Central Park recently.
Yeah, you know, everyone sent me that. As a matter of fact, USA Today just about an hour ago asked me to, you know, talk to them tomorrow about it. So I'm going to do that tomorrow. So
yeah,
yeah, I heard about it. Pretty cool. Good for the snowy owl. Good for New Yorkers, Central Park, and Sounds like it's been quite a long time since one's landed there.
Yeah, and we've got a link on our site to the Twitter photo of from a New Yorker who just snapped a picture of it out in Central Park. It's kind of fun. Well, you know, I know when I talked to you to get ready for the show, you said, "Well, I can't." We're still pulling our research together and all, but one of the things you talked about was that you determined that the males deliver the fattest lemmings to the females. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, we've done a lot of things and we've published some papers and all that, but it's one of those things. I'm a long-term field researcher, and so, you know, each year I think, one more year. And so that's why it goes on and on and on. But I think that's important in the end. One of the things that we were looking at is, you know, comparing our lemming index to what the owls bring at the nest, what we find in their pellets, you know, things like that. So looking at snowy owl diet and food habits. But an interesting thing was that when we started looking at our sampling of lemmings, which we do, you know, I try to do it three times a summer, every year, but, you know, pretty close to every year. And one of the things we're looking at was that the prey that we found at the nest were really big. You know, I mean, they were big lemmings piled up at the nest. The most we've seen piled up is like 86 lemmings. And then when we started looking at body masses and sex ratios of those piled up at the nest that the male would bring into the females and comparing that with what we did in our sampling scheme, we found out that the males were bringing in lemmings that were twice as big as the lemmings that we were getting in our sampling scheme. And so kind of, we kind of thought about it a little bit and wondered, you know, well, what's going on here? And so are they passing up those smaller lemmings and just bringing the females the big ones? Are they eating the smaller lemmings themselves? But we don't quite know that answer, but for sure, you know, statistically speaking anyway, that the males are bringing the biggest, heaviest lemmings to the nesting females when we compare that with our sampling scheme, if our sampling scheme is true indication of what's out there. So, so it's just kind of interesting. So maybe that's exactly what they're doing. They're like, all right, I got mouths to feed, I got a female to feed, I got chicks in the nest, and it's not worth bringing little tiny lemmings. So I'll either eat them, pass them up, but what I bring back to the nest is the biggest, heaviest lemmings. And so anyway, if we look at the ratio of how many big, heavy lemmings, and lemmings that weigh 90 grams, 100 grams, 110 grams versus, you know, 30, 40, and 50 grams.
Yeah.
In our sampling scheme.
You
know,
this
is happening.
And I think you did mention that the lemmings are declining on the North Slope and the snowy owls seem to be declining, and that might be an indicator of climate change. Is that too strong a statement to make, Denver?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm like super careful on the whole climate change thing because it seems to be the default answer for everything. But our numbers of snowy owls nests and our lemming sampling is on a downward trend. And the reasons for that, we're not sure. We started to look at some of this climate data, and just preliminary, we're looking at June precipitation in relation to this, and we didn't seem to find an association. But we have a lot more to do. We need to look at snowfall and the quality of snow. That's what we're stuck right now, is trying to figure out, has the snow quality changed? You know, is it a different type of snow now that we've seen increases in temperature and things like that versus, you know, years ago when snow might have been a little bit different? So we're trying to talk to snow experts and say, is there a way to quantify the quality of snow versus, you know, the snow has changed? And so that's what we're looking at. You know, my gut feeling is yes, something is going on. And when it affects lemmings, it affects everything up there. You know, lemmings are the key to a lot of production for most species on the tundra at Upiagvik or Barrow, formerly Barrow, where I work. So when lemmings have a good year, not only do snowy owls, you know, lay more eggs, raise more young, have more nests, but, you know, there's more foxes. The ground nesting birds have a better year. So the eider ducks have a better year. The shorebirds have a better year. Everything seems to have a better year when lemmings are abundant. And for two reasons is what it appears. And the one is that everything is eating lemmings. And so your ground nesting birds, like your ducks and your shorebirds, foxes, weasels, et cetera, aren't preying on them as much as they are in years when there's not so many lemmings because everybody's eating lemmings, including the owls, et cetera, the gulls, the Jaegers, and all that stuff. So lemmings are the key, but there seems to be a downward trend in the lemmings and snowy owls.
Yeah. Denver, I wanted to mention that your website, the Owl Research Institute, has a lot of owl research going on, and it's filled with information, pretty accessible information for the general public. We've got a link to that on our website. You also turned me on to a live cam of a long-eared owl, which is like a 24/7 live cam on a nest of long-eared owls. And I've gotten kind of hooked on that. And I just want our listeners to know, if they're interested in that, we've got a link on our website to it. And it's just, I find myself, they get kind of active later in the day. And as the night comes on, they groom and preen. And suddenly I look away and I look back and they're gone. And so that's just kind of fun to get to watch them. Let's see. I also, something else I want to mention briefly with you, Denver, is you're committed to sharing information with the public, because that is the way that owls will have a constituency, I guess you could say, and, you know, maybe start to care about their habitat and worry about how they're doing. One of the things that you mentioned was that humans are attracted to owls, in your view. And could you just talk a little bit about why that is? They don't look like other birds. They really look different. What is the attraction of humans to owls? You certainly fell prey to it yourself. So what do you think?
Yeah, you know, you get asked that question all the time, you know, and I've thought about it a zillion times, you know. And I guess the end would be, I think that they look like us. I think we're attracted to animals with big heads like us. We have a big head. We have, you know, hair. Owls have feathers that are kind of fluffed out, and a fluffy head. We have symmetry around the eyes and the nose and the mouth, and a relatively flat face. And I think that is it. I think there's big eyes and the symmetry and the flat face and the hair in the head and the tufts and the feathers all make owls pretty attractive. And then in addition to that, it's their... maybe even their hoots and their toots and their screams in the night. You know, there's something about it. Every culture has stories about owls. Whether they like them or not, you'll find in every culture we've investigated, going back all the way to the cavemen in the Paleolithic period, you know, the first etchings of birds are on caves in France, where they believe it's a snowy owl family and maybe like an eagle owl that are scratched into these caves in France 15 to 30,000 years ago. So there is something about owls. And I would argue it in anything that they are probably one of the most widely recognized groups of birds in the world, and clearly one of the most popular groups of birds in the world, of animals for that. And when snowy owls venture south from Alaska in a good breeding year, as they move south in their first migrations, and they show up in particularly the Great Lakes in the Northeast United States and Southern Canada, they show up in enormous numbers. Everyone stops and goes out and looks at them. It's not just, you know, people who have an interest in wildlife. I mean, it's just everyone. Family groups go out. Old folks' homes go out. Everyone goes out to see the great white owl of the north that comes down certain times. You know, it's not every year, but these eruption migrations occur, and everyone goes out to see them. So they're incredibly popular. Owls in general, and then you take the big white great owl of the north, the snowy owl, and it brings it to a whole nother level. There's something magical about the white animals that I can't really place it, but there's something about that we go, oh, the white bear, the white wolf, the white ptarmigan, the white snowy owl, and it just takes it to another level. So anyway, if you want to protect, you know, the environment, you're talking about conservation, if you got an owl in the areas that you want to protect, you want to highlight the owl because everyone will fall in line.
Yeah. Denver, I'm going to just go ahead, and I got a question in by email from a fellow, Stuart, who wants to know. It's a Sawhut owl call, and he said he was listening to Bird Note, and, you know, we played a Sawhut owl call, and it's kind of a beep, 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 and he says that it's sensitive to the cold. It gets slower and slower in colder weather, and he wonders, you know, how temperature does affect it. Do you know that? Do you know whether it would affect the call?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure exactly the question, whether the rhythm gets slow. You know, the Sawhut, too, is... And so I don't know if he's saying if it gets colder, the rhythm slows down, or if he's saying when it gets colder, they're not as vocal. What we see is during the onset of the breeding season, when the weather gets warmer is that there's an increase in hooting and tooting in all the owl species because it's the onset of breeding. And so a nice warm night, the sowlets will just be cranking up and whistling away trying to attract mates for mating. So I'm not sure exactly what he's saying, and it would be new to me if it was a slower rhythm, but it's not unusual that on these nice warm spring nights at the onset of breeding is when they really turn up their
They pick
their
it up.
Songs.
Yeah. Well, Denver.
You know, there's a snowy owl webcam, too. You know, the only time in the whole world owls have been viewed 24/7 has been in Barrow. And it doesn't happen every year because they don't breed every year. But on our webcam, you can see the highlights of the snowy owl breeding 24/7 at Barrow. Same thing. As long as you're watching.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I know we've got owl enthusiasts listening today, and we've got all those links on alaskapublic.org/hometown. So hopefully they will find their way there. So, Stuart, I'm going to say goodbye to you. I wish, perhaps we can have you back sometime when you're wrapping up your snowy owl research and we can learn what you've decided is fact about the snowy owls and the lemmings up on the North Slope. But I want to say thank you so much and goodbye. Good luck. And I'm going to welcome back Gina Maria and Colin back onto the show. I had mentioned Travis Booms, who was really helpful in getting me to Denver, but also he's done research on short-eared owls, and we have a link to some of his papers that explain basically that their habitats are threatened. They're migrators, and their habitat is threatened as grasslands in the lower 48 disappear. I'm coming back to you, Gina Maria. How are you doing? How is Archimedes doing? We only have about a minute left.
We're doing well. We've been enjoying getting to hear all the important information that's shared by Denver Holt and by Andrew, and it's always just fascinating to when you get a chance to hear and meet with all the people who are enthusiastic about owls. And I mean, that's really the most important thing, is that people love owls and are interested in them, and the more that we can encourage that and share facts and information and our enthusiasm, the better it will be for not only the owls, but for all the other birds and animals that are surrounding them and that they rely on as well.
Yeah. And Colin, we only have about 20 seconds, but any parting thoughts for our listeners today?
Owls can be difficult to locate. They are masters of camouflage, but I think of them as like finding the four-leaf clover or finding Waldo. Once you believe they're present, you will see them more and develop an eye for discerning shapes and movement and things like that as far as locating owls.
So don't be dissuaded. If they take a little time to locate, there comes our closing music. So I have to say, I have to thank Archimedes, Gina Maria Smith, Colin Tyler, Denver Holt, Andrew Fisher, and our listeners and callers today. Next week on Hometown Alaska, we'll visit with an Alaska mystery writer, Dana Stabenow, upon the release of her new novel, Spoils of the Dead. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Will Franklin was our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.